chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make to heaven in the middle of it. Rest make to heaven in the middle. We are rest make to heaven.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Well, we finally, after 15 ballots, have a new Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy. And it took him a while. There were six Republicans that voted present, and I think that opened up the threshold that enabled him to get the votes that he needed to confirm himself as the new Speaker of the House. We're going to have that in this program tonight, and some of the goods and bads and ugly by PBS. We've got a clip up on that, but we've got some other interesting ideas of what's going on, and it looks like that the physical shutdown is going to occur by this conservative group. In other words, they're not going to let this runaway spending continue. But anyway, we've got, we're beginning the night here with a couple of three clips by Greg Reese, one after the other. They were just too good for me to ignore for too long. And so we're going with all three clips right in a row. And the first one, it's about Satanism, and then we'll go from there. One's about the inevitable collapse of the dollar, and another one is about, enlightenment and so forth. But anyway, here we go, coming up with the Satanism clip by Greg Reese, and really does a fine job. Here we go with Greg Reese.
This video is based on the work of Mark Passio from whatonearthishappening.com, specifically his recent video on de facto Satanism. Today's Hollywood pop culture machine will have you believe that Satanists wear robes and practice ritualistic blood sacrifices while worshiping Satan. And while there may be some truth to this, it is mostly propaganda meant to conceal the reality of what Satanism actually is. True Satanism is a mindset, and the Satan that is worshipped is within each and every one of us. It is most commonly known as our ego. The self is the true god of Satanism. The term Satanism is used to deceive religious people, to appear harmless to non-religious people, and also because it stems from the Hebrew word Shatan, which means adversary. Satan is the force of involution that opposes true spiritual evolution. It is the ego within us. Left to our own devices, the ego will try and convince us to think only of ourselves, which is exactly what Satanism is. And so, a de facto Satanist is a person who holds this mindset, but does not consider themselves to be a Satanist. Organized Satanism stands against this sort of enlightenment. They believe human psychology and the laws of nature should be kept occulted or hidden from the public and used to gain and retain power over the masses by keeping them ignorant as to how the mind and emotions work, while using this knowledge to manipulate the masses and ultimately enslave them. This is primarily done by cultivating the Satanist mindset among the masses, thereby turning the ignorant and unaware into a de facto Satanist. As we think, so we become. This mindset can be broken down into four main tenets of Satanism. The first and most important is selfishness, egotism, or what many know as narcissism. Self-preservation is the highest law. Live only for your own selfish desires and only care about you and yours. It's a dog-eat-dog world, and if you must step on others to get what you want, then so be it. This is the basis of satanic thinking. The second tenet of the Satanist mindset is moral relativism. This is the belief that there is no objective difference between right behavior and wrong behavior. It is the belief that nobody is ever objectively right or wrong, and that it's up to each individual person to decide for themselves what is right and what is wrong. The third tenet of Satanism is social Darwinism. This is the belief that it is natural and good for human society to be ruled by the most aggressive and dominant humans among us, and that it is by virtue of their genetics that these vicious humans deserve to be in positions of power and lead humanity as they so choose. The fourth tenet of Satanism is eugenics or dysgenics. This is the ideal conclusion of the Satanist mindset. Since man is God and he gets to decide what is right and what is wrong, and since the natural order is for the most dominant genetics to have power, then the elite class ruling over us has every right to decide who is allowed to live and procreate and who must die. This is how all of society is conditioned to think. And this is how the high-level Satanists are leading all of humanity into slavery. Most of humanity is operating under this de facto satanic mindset, which is why it is called the Great Work to change it. The Great Work is the work of awakening the masses to the true nature of the ego mind, encouraging each and every individual to find the courage to face their own inner shadow and to practice natural law. Natural law is the respect of others. Put simply, it is love. If the majority of humanity is practicing love, then humanity will know freedom. But if the majority of humanity is practicing Satanism, then humanity will be enslaved. You can find much more of this information at whatonearthishappening.com. Reporting for InfoWars, this is Greg Reese.
Well, that he really puts out some good stuff. Coming up next is inevitable collapse of the dollar, and then we'll go with his third pronouncement here. But this inevitable collapse of the dollar came out about a month ago. I was a little late putting some of this stuff up. I missed it. Well, here we go with inevitable collapse of the dollar.
The last economic reset occurred in 1944 with the creation of the Bretton Woods system. The U.S. dollar replaced the pound sterling as the new world reserve currency and was convertible to gold at a fixed rate of $35 an ounce. Nations of the world entrusted the Federal Reserve Bank to hold their gold in return for market liquidity. This trust was good, up until President de Gaulle of France pointed out that the United States was printing more money than they had in gold reserves to pay for the war in Vietnam, and in 1971 sent a warship to New York demanding their gold back. Days later, President Nixon took the world off the gold standard altogether, allowing the war machine to print endless amounts of U.S. dollars. In 1974, the United States offers use of its war machine to Saudi Arabia in return for their oil to be sold exclusively with U.S. dollars. This becomes known as the petrodollar and ushers in a new era of endless warfare. Andy Schechtman of Miles Franklin has been trading precious metals for over 30 years and lays out the evidence that the world is going back to a gold standard. In 2017, Germany's Bundesbank made headlines when they demanded the return of their physical gold by 2020. Within weeks, the Bank of Austria, the Bank of Hungary, the Bank of Turkey, the Czech National Bank, and the Bank of Poland all quietly began repatriating their gold as well and began buying more. These banks bought more in 2018 than they had bought in the last 60 years combined, and they doubled that the next year. In 2019, the Bank for International Settlements classifies gold as a Tier 1 reserve, rivaling the U.S. dollar for the first time in 80 years. In 2020, the International Monetary Fund publicly announces a shift towards a new system to replace Bretton Woods. Also that year, a new major buyer suddenly appears, anonymously labeled as Other, and begins draining the COMEX and London Metals Exchange of precious metals to an extent never seen before. In August of 2021, Saudi Arabia signs a military cooperation agreement with Russia, directly challenging the U.S. petrodollar agreement. This is immediately followed by the U.S. military's abrupt departure from Afghanistan. In 2022, Russian banks were removed from the SWIFT system. This weaponization of the banking system inspired a massive sell-off of U.S. treasuries, as Russia and China announce a new commodity-backed world reserve currency. Nigeria, Saudi Arabia, and Iran begin selling oil to China for bonds that are immediately convertible to gold. BRICS membership is now nearing 90% of the world population, and all these countries are dramatically expanding their gold reserves. China's Belt and Road Initiative is moving towards connecting nearly three-quarters of the world population into its centralized system with the digital Chinese yuan. And the U.S. government is left holding a bill they can't pay and a war machine they can't afford. The U.S. Mint is making it difficult for citizens to buy gold and silver, as if they want everyone at their mercy when it all goes to zero. Their only solution seems to be total control. This is at least one of the reasons why Elon's Twitter files are spread out like a Netflix series, to keep Americans busy while their entire life savings are swiftly turned to zero. Reporting for InfoWars, this is Greg Reese.
Okay, our third and last Greg Reese special is about enlightenment. And I always say you got to go about it through forgiveness, is that is the way to really become enlightened. But anyway, we'll see what he has to say. He says always says very profound, I should say, things. And so he's quite someone to listen to, that's for sure. But here we go with Greg Reese about enlightenment.
A key component of human life is enlightenment, the awakening from the darkness of deception into the light of truth. The so-called Great Awakening has really been going on forever. And before MAGA and QAnon, the consensus was that the banks were at the top of the criminal pyramid structure. And while many of us assumed that a hidden hand was pulling their strings as well, we realized that their main goal was a digital currency and a cashless society. It was the subject of several documentaries.
The ultimate goal that these people have in mind is the goal to create a one-world government run by the banking industry, run by the bankers, right? There'll be no more cash. And this is giving me straight from Rockefeller himself. This is what they want to accomplish. And all money will be in your chips. And if you're like me or you, and you're protesting what they're doing, they can just turn off your chip. And you have nothing. You can't buy food. You can't do anything. It's total control of the people.
And that chip's connected to a database that has your purchasing records, what you do, what
everything.
You sell.
Everything is in there.
And it was also commonly discussed that they'll likely use Big Pharma to get us there.
Yes, there have been corrupt empires. Yes, they manipulate. Yes, there are secret societies. Yes, there have been oligarchies throughout history. And yes, today in 2002, there is a tyrannical organization calling itself the New World Order, pushing for worldwide government, a cashless society, open borders, total and complete tyranny. And by creating open borders where there's no national sovereignty and only global bodies that control all the resources, by centralizing and socializing health care, the state becomes God, basically, when it comes to your health. And then by releasing diseases and viruses and plagues upon us, we then basically get shoved into their system.
But now it's as if everyone has just accepted it and found something else to fight about, because the cashless society is being rolled out right now, and very few people seem bothered by it. In November of 2019, right before COVID, the Institute of Politics at Harvard Kennedy School had a live tabletop exercise called Digital Currency Wars, which looked at how the United States can continue to leverage economic power in a world of national digital currencies, such as the Chinese digital yuan, which is already heavily competing in trade against the U.S. dollar and seems to be at the forefront of centralized digital currencies. And it has an expiry date. If you don't spend it by then, it becomes worthless, so people can no longer save money. The Bank of International Settlements has announced that the central bank will have absolute control on the rules and regulations and will have technologies to enforce it. The Central Bank of Brazil is planning to launch their centralized digital currency in 2024. Israel is about to launch theirs, and the Bank of England is now preparing a UK digital currency. Italy's new Prime Minister, Meloni, is speaking out against the cashless society, but she seems to stand alone on the world stage. In the Federal Reserve's digital currency scheme, it appears that Hedera and Quant will be used on the technology side. They are already connected to everything. The cashless society is here, but everyone is talking about Hunter Biden's laptop. The goal was never to put an old senile puppet into the presidency to run havoc. The goal was to create a cashless society. And so while bringing Joe Biden to justice may feel like a victory, the tyrants are still getting exactly what they wanted. And once it's all said and done, then who will save you?
And if you're like me or you, and you're protesting what they're doing, they can just turn off your chip. And you have nothing. You can't buy food. You can't do anything.
Reporting for InfoWars, this is Greg Reese.
Next, we've got a clip I picked up from PBS. Usually they're extremely liberal, but this one, it has some foundation and think tank people that are injecting a few things that we ourselves on the political right or conservative right or whatever should pay attention to, because we can learn from any of these people that express some of these types of ideas that are important for us to maintain some kind of a semblance of governorship here, if at all. But here we go with the U.S. PBS special talking about what the Democrats are going to do now that they have their Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, in there, and what kind of antagonistic fight or conflict they might come in or evolve into. So here we there's a short interview, but it's very worthwhile listening to. And then I'll pick up some Fox stuff and what they said about some of the commentators there about the takeover of the House by the Republicans. But here we go with that PBS special.
Good evening. There is finally a Speaker of the House of Representatives. After 4 days of defeats and deal-making, Republican Kevin McCarthy was elected to the job early this morning on the 15th try. That's the most since before the Civil War.
So help you God.
Yes, I do.
Congratulations and Godspeed.
His victory came during a dramatic and sometimes rancorous session.
Jeffries.
After he fell one vote short on the 14th try, McCarthy confronted holdouts Matt Gaetz of Florida and Lauren Boebert of Colorado. Tempers flared. At one point, McCarthy supporter Mike Rogers of Alabama had to be restrained. After winning the post that had eluded him for years, McCarthy outlined a conservative agenda that included investigations of the Biden administration.
We will hold the swamp accountable. From the withdrawal of Afghanistan to the origins of COVID and to the weaponization of the FBI. Let me be very clear. We will use the power of the purse and the power of the subpoena to get the job done.
Later, he credited a key backer for helping him get across the finish line.
I do want to especially thank President Trump. I don't think anybody should doubt his influence. All members elect will raise their right hand.
The election of a speaker cleared the way to formally assemble the 118th Congress as House members took the oath of office.
Congratulations. You are now members of the 118th Congress.
McCarthy's victory came after a series of concessions that give hardline conservatives greater influence in the House, notably on spending and tax bills. What did McCarthy's prolonged battle and the deals he cut mean for his leadership, for the House, and for the governing of the nation? Sarah Binder is a George Washington University political scientist and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Sarah, one of the things that that Speaker McCarthy said last night is, what we do here today, next week, next month, and next year will set the tone for everything that follows. What tone was set by what happened this week?
Well, what we watched play out in front of us in levels of detail we're not usually accustomed to on C-SPAN was a very slim, fractured majority trying to get on the same page. And what we saw was the speaker-to-be, in doubt at times, trying to figure out how much could he give away to his opponents and would they take it? Would they take these concessions that they were demanding and then give him his votes? We'll see those fractures emerge throughout this coming Congress for sure.
In what ways? Look ahead, and in what ways are we going to see those fractures?
So one of the core issues that divides the holdouts from Speaker McCarthy is the question about the federal budget, federal deficits, and federal debt. And there are two things this Congress, like most Congresses, will have to do at some point. Mostly in the fall, they will need to pass spending bills, get them through the House, the Senate, and the White House, pass spending bills that most recently raise federal spending, both for domestic side and defense side. But his opponents have vowed not to do that. They want to cut. They want to cut both defense spending, which the defense hawks in the Republican Party aren't going to want to do, and they're going to want to severely cut domestic spending. And it's not clear that 218 Republicans, even, especially those from swing districts won by President Biden, it's not clear they're going to go along. So how do you keep the government funded and open? Will there be a government shutdown?
Do you think any of these concessions may come back to haunt him?
Well, I think the key concessions here, first of all, are Speaker McCarthy's willingness and his agreement to put three Freedom Caucus members from the far right of the conference, to put them on the Rules Committee, which is an arm of the Republican leadership. That's the committee that decides which bills will go to the floor, under what conditions, will there be amendments, who will offer the amendments. With three Freedom Caucus members on that committee, it's going to put them in a position to try to advance their policies, not just to block things on the floor that they've sort of mastered in the past. I think that could come back to haunt Speaker McCarthy. Others will point to this motion to vacate the speakership. That's existed in the past. I think McCarthy, it's a thin reed that he's standing on already, and that threat of deposing him, it's going to be put a little more oomph behind those threats.
You talk about a slim, fractured majority. I mean, the fact that it was just really about 20 members that tied the House up in knots, are we going to see more of that?
McCarthy comes into the speakership, by all accounts, quite weakened by what he's given away. And I think that's going to encourage not just the original five holdouts and not merely the 20 who secured some concessions in this deal-making over the speakership. I think that will encourage other members of the Republican majority to come forward and to push their perspectives as well. Right? Think about those, you know, one and a half, it's about 18 members who are elected in districts that President Biden won. Those folks aren't going to be that happy lining up behind the agenda of the Freedom Caucus. And that's trouble ahead. That's really trouble ahead for Speaker McCarthy.
Sarah Binder of George Washington University and the Brookings Institution, thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
He makes some profound statements in here about these social networks and also about the FBI having been weaponized against us. So I don't know if he's going to be able to pull, all of this off, so to speak. But we'll just have to wait and see. And try to do our best to support those people, okay, that we feel that can make the difference. for the country. What's interesting now with this next one is that this was the night before they finally got the 15th ballot through. But this was interesting because this was Boebert from Colorado, and then it had Gats from Florida. It seems that many of these conservative rights are coming out of Florida. It looks like DeSantis is behind some of these really right-wing conservative types of Republicans that want to stop this wild spending and so forth. But and this is, will be good for the country. And this is sort of on Hannity goes tit for tat, and he says maintains, well, they should have done this in the back room. Well, I think what we saw in that House and all the negotiation is a really true form of democracy and negotiation and compromise. And McCarthy has been a bit of a rhino on certain issues and has not supported some of the people like Laura Loomer and others that were denied the support by him. So he's not Lily White either. But he started out with 200 votes, and it was a difficult thing to try to overcome. But here's what Hannity had to say with Boebert and Gats right before that final vote on Friday. But here we go with that.
All right, welcome back to Hannity. We continue with our live studio audience this Friday night. Now it's time for the Hannity Hot Seat. And we are joined by two of the six House members, those that have been against Kevin McCarthy in every vote to date. Now, the question tonight is, will their opposition continue in the next vote, which is likely in less than an hour? And joining us now, Colorado Congresswoman Lauren Boebert and Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz. Good to see you both. I've been in contact with you both this week. Matt yelled
sure
at
have,
me
Sean.
Once or twice. By the way, Laura, Congresswoman, can we settle something? We had a passionate debate this week.
We did.
Now,
hey, Sean, I welcome you to get passionate like that all the time because LaurenForFreedom.com blew up that night.
I hope I raised a lot of money for your next campaign or helped you raise money. But I said to you during that debate, it's interesting how people perceive things. I said, there's probably very little we disagree on. And where I was frustrated was, well, you didn't answer the question. And I have a pet peeve about that. But it's not I've never been opposed to you. And I said on the air the next day, I said, no, we were texting after the debate. And I said, no, we're friends. We just had a disagreement in terms of whether or not the agenda items were in cement. I thought they were. Did you perceive it the same way?
Sean, I thought it was a very exhilarating debate that we had. And usually I'm one of the 20 people who are opposing something and you are cheering on. So, you know, we just were on a different side on this issue. And then, you know, of course, there were others on the show like Trey Gowdy that said that we were on there just for personal gain and holding out for that. And nothing could be further from the truth. Myself, Matt Gaetz, and every single one of the 20 conservatives that demanded these changes did so for the good of the country, full stop.
Where are you tonight on Kevin McCarthy?
Well, I believe that when this is all over, everyone from the speaker's office to my more moderate colleagues, even friends and allies that I've exchanged some tough words with, like yourself, we will work together to deliver historic fundamental changes in D.C. We will have conservative solutions on important issues facing the American people. So we'll see how tonight goes. I think that there are some things that we need to get locked in and make sure that we are able to deliver on these promises.
Are you confident, say, by Monday the latest that this will be over and Kevin will be the speaker and you will have the assurances that you need that all the agenda items you have campaigned on and that you fought for are going to be implemented by the new Congress?
I sure hope by Monday we see something, something that is promising to deliver for the American people. And I truly believe that after months of the negotiations that we've seen and a few extra days even of being assembled on the House floor, Republicans are going to be far more prepared to lead and more prepared to govern than ever before.
Matt Gaetz, where are you tonight?
Well, Sean, this has never been about me or Kevin McCarthy. It's about the American people. And the American people want to know that the rules of the House of Representatives would never allow something like this terrible, horrendous omnibus bill to ever pass, ever again. And that's what Congresswoman Boebert and I have been working on. And while I know that sometimes these discussions can be a little awkward up front, I guess it's like a prenuptial agreement that you'd be preparing. Sometimes there can be some uncomfortable moments in the preparation, but it can be necessary. I am excited and encouraged. I am grateful that Speaker-designate McCarthy has been so receptive to each and every change that we have demanded. And, Sean, we're at the stage right now where I'm running out of stuff to ask for. I mean, read the bills, have a balanced budget, have a border plan. Yes. Kevin McCarthy is agreeing to all these things. And again, it's never been about him. It's been about draining the swamp, making this a more honest, transparent, open place. And we may have a few finishing touches. We may be able to get this resolved tonight. But I am proud of the entire Republican conference. And we're going to be stronger and more unified and more able to hold this administration accountable because we have had these early moments of sorting things out.
So we had communication from in December, pretty early in December, and you're free to talk about anything you want. And my admonition to a number of people, because I saw all of this coming, I would have preferred that it happened before January 3rd. We ultimately seem to have gotten there. Was I wrong in anticipating that this was headed in this direction? Would it have been better to maybe do it behind closed doors?
Well, Sean, I love you, but if I would have voted for Speaker McCarthy when you asked me to on Monday, we wouldn't have the spending caps. We wouldn't have
points of order available for members.
So I would say
you may love me, but that's not what I asked you.
We did very well driving a hard bargain.
What I said was, correct me if I'm wrong, I wanted everybody early on, way before January 3rd, to get in a room, lock the door, check their egos, check your phone, fight it out behind closed doors and be ready on January 3rd. Now, with that said, you know what? None of this has ever bothered me. I think at the end, if this would go on another week, I think it would drive the American people nuts. But ultimately, it is the agenda to save this country. This country is in a mess. The Democrats have run this country into a ditch. This president doesn't know what day it is. Look at the debt. Look at energy policy. Look at our borders, our southern borders. We need a united Republican Party to fight hard. I think we now have that. Is that a fair statement, Matt Gaetz?
I really think that we are coalescing around that vision. I'm very optimistic about where we are right now.
Good.
But we simply would not allow business as usual to continue. And that wasn't personal toward anyone. That was a problem with Washington that existed under both Republicans and Democrats. And Lauren Boebert and I hear from our constituents that they want this town to change. And these fundamental changes, if we can get the finishing touches on them, they will far outlast Lauren Boebert and I. They will far outlast Kevin McCarthy. And they will be there to deliver for the American people and stop these terrible spending bills that are pushing our country into debt and borrowing against the futures of the next generation.
I think we just disagreed at different points. I know things had been agreed to behind closed doors, and maybe it didn't filter down to the rank and file, but also people did want an agreement. They wanted it in writing. They wanted greater commitments. I really don't fault anybody for that. At the end of the day, it's about the country. It's about serving your constituents. It's about the American people and serving them. They are the people that would get hurt if you don't do your job. Congressman Gaetz, always great to have you. Congresswoman Boebert, you know what? Thank you for having a passionate debate, and we fully support your candidacy.
So much fun.
Already I'm endorsing you for your next term, okay, so everybody knows.
Thank you so much. I hope people still go to laurenforfreedom.com even when it's peaceful.
Sure, why not? I'm coming on Hannity. I might as well get a plug-in for the website, my next election. I love it. Hey, Sean Hannity here. Hey, click here to subscribe to Fox News YouTube page and catch our hottest interviews and most compelling analysis. You will not get it anywhere else.
If you recall and listening to this, and you can go back and listen to it at thesecrettruth.com, he said that he would support her. Hannity said he would support Boebert next time that she was in Congress. And so she's quite a pistol. You know, I think she took a pistol into the House one time, but they frowned on that. But anyways, This is an interview coming up next with Hearn, whose name was placed on the ballot, I believe, once or twice. His name appeared, and he got just a few handful of votes when his name went up. But this is about what he thinks the good that will come out of this negotiation that finally took place between these two groups in the House, the Republican groups. And, of course, the Democrats trying to make it like, oh, it's a carnival and so forth. But this is Hearn being interviewed, what he had to say about what he thinks is good that's come out of this hard-nosed negotiation for Speaker of the House.
Kevin McCarthy is officially sworn in as Speaker of the House, and this after a marathon 4 days, 15 rounds of voting. Oklahoma Congressman Kevin Hearn's name was thrown out for Speaker a few times as the process played out.
The Honorable Kevin Hearn of the state of Oklahoma has received 7.
Rosendale.
Kevin.
Hearn.
Congressman Kevin Hearn joins us now with his reaction. Congressman, great to have you on the program. Despite being nominated there and supported on several rounds of voting, you did vote for Speaker McCarthy in all 15 rounds of voting. Tell me, as you saw this process play out and you saw some of these concessions that were made in the negotiations, how do you feel about Speaker McCarthy's ability to bring the Republican constituency together moving forward?
Well, thanks for having me. The real winner in this was the American people. You all have reported on this for the last 4 years and before that even, that the American people are tired of a dysfunctional Congress where we're spending money that's out of control, that's just devastating our future, our generations, for our kids and grandkids. And then what we've seen with the wokeism that's gone on, and what you've seen over this last 4 days is really just a resetting of where Congress should have been at a long time ago. Having negotiated a lot of deals in my lifetime in 35 years of business on a very large scale, this is what you see happen in negotiations. And they're really, everybody was involved in this. Speaker Pelosi caused this, but the damage that she's done to Congress over the last 4 years. And now we have Speaker McCarthy, who has worked hard over the last 4 days, I would argue for the last 4 months, to get us to this point. And I felt until he couldn't move these negotiations forward, I would continue to vote for him. And when that didn't happen, then we'd all have to look at a different direction.
Do you worry, Congressman, when it comes to policy, when it comes to making law, that that Republicans will run into similar difficulty in getting everybody on the same page? It'll continue to have holdouts, be it the Freedom Caucus or whatever it may be, that put him in a position of having trouble getting to a majority?
Well, certainly it's going to be hard work, and he certainly understands that. He understands the rules, meaning Speaker McCarthy understands the rules that's been negotiated and what he has to live under. Using his words, he said, I'm not afraid, and we'll take him at his word for that, and we'll all work together. As the chairman myself of the Republican Study Committee, which is all about policy, some 170 of the 222 members, so a very large swath, from the farthest right to more moderate Republicans, we're going to work alongside to help him push for the most conservative outcome of every bill that's put forward. One of the big issues in this negotiation was around spending. We're out of control in our spending. And the second part of this was empowering the members of Congress so that the voice of the members could be heard when they came to Congress. And that's what we needed to work on, and we got that done.
You may have just begun to answer that question for me, but I did want to, on the list of concessions, which I believe we still have, we can put them up on the screen here, that were part of this negotiation. Would you mind telling me, what do you think on that list? What do you think is the biggest victory? What worries you the most, perhaps, as well, on that list of concessions?
Well, I think probably just because I spent the last 2 years writing the only two budgets that have been done in Congress in my 4 years here, and so I've seen this at the very detailed level of the largest budgets in the world. And so getting to the balanced budget, of which the RAC put out one last year that I chaired for 6 years, this year was about 7 years. And so actually doing that, I think that's exciting for the American people. Everybody in America has to balance their budgets. The one I think is going to be the most challenging for us because of the small margins is making sure we pass all the 12 appropriation bills so that we can send to the Senate and hold them accountable for making America more fiscally responsible for the American taxpayer dollars.
Hey, Congressman, I really appreciate you answering that question directly. I asked you for both your biggest concern and your biggest excitement on that list, and you didn't dodge either of them. That right there is a refreshing start to the 118th Congress. So I appreciate you being on the show this morning. Thank you, Congressman Kevin Hern.
Thanks, Will.
I'm Steve Ducey.
I'm Brian Kilmeade.
And I'm Ainsley Earhart. And click here to subscribe to the Fox News YouTube page to catch our hottest interviews and most compelling analysis.
Now, this settles somewhat the speaker's race for a while, and they'll be in there for 2 years. But they only have an edge. I think they have 222 House members, which is just a few over, about four over majority. So the Democrats are going to be fiercely put together, united, and they showed that on their votes. In the Speaker of the House, both they were solidly all together. So evidently Pelosi and other leaders in the House for the Democrats do have a solid voting block there to contend with. So it's not going to be easy to try to negotiate anything with them and try to reach any type of compromises of any kind with them. Coming up next is an interview that Owen Sawyer had with Dr. McCullough about the Hamlin collapse, football player collapsed, heart failure. And Dr. McCullough still believes that it could be vaccine related. And so this is what he lays out. He lays out some very technical medical jargon and opinions, but towards the end he does express his view that he believes that it's possibly they're not. 95% of the NFL players were vaccinated or vaccines, you could say, so they have a high incident of vaccine, and it remains to be seen if we have any more events like this out there because of heart damage that possibly the vaccine might have caused. But anyway, here's Dr. McCullough. And he said, always very insightful, very honorable person, a good man to listen to.
Owen Troyer.
Well, it's a great honor and privilege to be joined now by Dr. Peter McCullough, and there is so much that we've got to get to with Dr. McCullough. First of all, a big announcement. Folks, you know about the wellness company, started with Dr. Peter McCullough and others. And now OnlineHealthNow.com, OnlineHealthNow.com. Folks, the resources are available. The good doctors are being made available to you. And this is all good news because we've learned not just to not have trust in our government institutions when it comes to health, but actually to have complete distrust, unfortunately, with everything we've seen post-COVID. And so Dr. McCullough joins me now. I also want to talk about the Fauci files. I want to talk about the situation with DeMar Hamlin, the NFL player. But Dr. Peter McCullough, as we bring you on today, where would you like to begin? I know there's a lot of things on your mind and plate right now as well.
Yeah, I really doubt a blood clot because, you know, he's in such good shape. He's great mobility. And it would be unlikely that that precipitated this electrical cardiac arrest. Now, believe me, blood clots have happened in the pro athletes. Max Maxwell, a New York Jets player, is sidelined because of blood clots, among others. So, there will be assessment for that, but I would doubt that clinically. I think it's a primary cardiac problem.
Now, you bring up the electrical issue here with the heart. Where does that come into play? Because obviously this is why the people continue to talk about the comatose cordis, because that deals with the electrical issues there. What about with the vaccine? Because I don't hear too many people talking about the electrical problems with the heart. How does that play in here?
When the COVID-19 vaccines, when they install the genetic code for the spike protein, it causes inflammation and a small scar develops weeks or months afterwards. And that's the site where a reentrant abnormal cardiac rhythm takes over in the setting of a surge of adrenaline, which is exactly, would be the context of him making that tackle. Big surge of adrenaline, and then he goes into a reentrant arrhythmia. All experts, myself included, have ruled out this commotio cordis suggestion, which has happened in baseball players, lacrosse players, hockey players. That's due to a projectile to an unprotected sternum. Football players take a helmet into the sternum, virtually.
All right, let me just pause right there because we got to take a break. Let's continue that on the other side. This is an important issue with Dr. Peter McCullough. We will be right back. Dr. Comicho Cordis is what they kept telling us, and I think we've all pretty much heard of that now, and we've seen the diagrams and everything that it means. And so it sounds like there's kind of a balance here where it was not necessarily the hit that caused a Comicho Cordis, but it was the hit, the adrenaline of the whole thing that perhaps caused him to go into cardiac arrest because there may have been some underlying issues ahead of that. So kind of pick it up where you last left off, why you think now it's completely fair to rule out the Comicho Cordis, even though that's what they want us to think it is.
How doctors do this, Owen, is we rule it out what's called mechanism of injury. The pads that protect the sternum, it's called the sternal plates in football, are there for a reason. In a study in American Journal of Cardiology in 2007, they proved that the football pads that go over the sternum now completely prevent any chance of commotio cordis. So we can completely rule that out. The players take helmets in the chest virtually every set of downs. I ruled that one out basically after I watched the replay a few times. I think it's ridiculous that any doctor went on TV and suggested that. It's just as ridiculous as doctors who went on TV and said it's not the vaccine without knowing the vaccine status.
Yeah, and I mean, I got a lot of flack for this too. I said I believe it was the hit that caused the event, but perhaps it was a vaccine status or injury that made a bad situation worse. And so we're still waiting for answers. But you know, here's the conversation that I see, or the future of the conversation, Dr. McCullough. I think it only goes two ways at this point, because look, I've covered the NFL long enough to know They're gonna try to not be honest. Let me just put it that way. They may not come out and lie to you, but they're gonna do everything they can to not be fully transparent and honest about this. But I don't know if they're gonna have a choice, because the conversation goes two ways at this point, Dr. McCullough. And as you just stated, if we can rule out Comicho Cordis, well, now we've gotta have this discussion, which is, one, football is now a sport where what is considered a routine tackle can cause a potentially life-ending event. That's a discussion that is going to have to be had if they're going to tell us this has nothing to do except he just had an event because of this play. Or they're going to have to come out and say, well, okay, there was an underlying condition that caused his cardiac event, and if it was caused by the vaccine, well, now you've got a whole nother issue. All the other NFL players are going to be concerned. But either way, the NFL players should be concerned. I think this Saturday and Sunday are going to be very interesting days, because you're either going to have the conversation where a normal routine hit for the NFL could be potentially life-ending, or all these vaccinated players are at a risk of having a cardiac arrest event on the field. Which way does the conversation go? I don't see it going any other way here, Dr. McCullough.
It's true. You know, I want to bring up one other possibility that fits with your analysis. There's a paper that appeared in European Journal of Cardiology Case Reports in 2021 by Gregory Basuli, and pointed out that patients who have myocarditis, these two cases in this paper were not due to COVID vaccines, it was before COVID, but if they do sustain blunt trauma, it can trigger a cardiac arrest. So not commotio cordis, but just the adrenaline and then also the mechanical force. But you're right, the players looked so unbelievably pale and nauseated. I know they were incredibly concerned about DeMar, but many of them probably thought, wait a minute, could I be the next person to go down on the field to play?
And that's, I think, what was so shocking. And we've seen really severe injuries in the NFL before. Obviously, we've seen broken bones, broken legs. We all remember that. There have been severe head, neck, back injuries that have caused some pretty serious scenes on the field, ambulances to come out, guys getting basically cut out of their equipment. And the difference has been, though, normally, either within a short period of time or before they even put the player in the ambulance, they either have signs of life or can confirm that, hey, he's had a serious injury, but he's going to be okay. We have the situation under control. That was not the case there. They sat there for almost 10 minutes and watched them trying to revive DeMar Hamlin. Thank God they were finally able to do so, but it took almost 10 minutes. So a lot of the guys were probably sitting there thinking, is this it for him? Has my friend, has my brother, has my colleague, is this it? Is this the last time we're going to see him going off this field in the ambulance? A very real situation. And again, like you said, it hasn't really been addressed. It hasn't really been rectified.
It's got to be tough for an NFL player now. The sport has always been dangerous, but this is a new level of danger. Like you said, you could see it on their faces.
We're going to end up with a clip from an interview that Tucker Carlson did with Colonel McGregor. And what's important about this clip is that there's war that's beginning to break out along the border between the Mexican government and the cartels. And there was a 50 caliber machine gun firing into a commercial liner down at one of the airports there along the border. And so this is getting really out of hand. And so this is what McGregor is saying. He said it goes back to a few years because of other incidents. But anyway, listen to this carefully, and this is important.
So Congress is continuing to send billions a month to Ukraine because that war is more important than any other war. But actually, there is a new war that really will affect Americans, and it's in Mexico. The Mexican Defense Forces, the Mexican Army, now battling the Sinaloa cartel in response to the arrest of the son of El Chapo. And as of tonight, the Mexican Defense Forces appear to be losing. Watch. We should have identified it. The clip you saw of people cowering in the commercial airliner, that plane was being shot at by a 50 cal from the drug cartels. So it's a war. Now, Biden is visiting the border this weekend. He has no plan to deal with any of this, but it will affect us. How could it not? Retired U.S. Army Colonel Doug McGregor has been following this for months now. He joins us tonight. Doug, thanks so much for coming on this. It would seem if a war breaks out in a country with whom you share this enormously long border, that there would be coverage of it. There hasn't been. Why?
Well, we're lucky to get this glimpse. The media simply doesn't bother to cover it. But we really need to understand what this war is about. In 2020, we arrested the Mexican Minister of Defense, a general named Cienfuegos, in California, on charges associated with drug trafficking, human trafficking, and a whole list of crimes. Ultimately, we turned him over to the president of Mexico, President Obrador, who promptly released him, and we dropped the charges. Now, one of the reasons we dropped the charges is that we were promised more cooperation, but it hasn't been forthcoming. And so what we're really seeing here is not an effort to enforce the law, not an effort to do anything good. It's a fight between a cartel, the Sinaloa cartel, and the Mexican army. They're fighting for turf, they're fighting for cash, they're fighting for influence inside Mexico. They want the son of El Chapo's, presumably, so they can give it to the president of Mexico and he can create the illusion that by turning him over to us, that there is cooperation with Mexico. Tucker, there's no cooperation with Mexico. And President Obrador is irrelevant. He does not run the country. He's a mouthpiece for the drug cartels.
So if the president of Mexico is a mouthpiece for the drug cartels and the government of Mexico has allowed millions of foreign nationals to stream over its territory into our country, sure, along with fentanyl that's killed hundreds of thousands of people in this country, why is Mexico not our main enemy?
Well, that's a good point, because Mexico right now and Central America writ large, because of the criminality, is an existential threat to us. It's the only truly existential threat to the country. And remember, they reach into the United States. All of your major cities, there are networks there that reach back into Mexico. That's why they're powerful. And that's a war that will eventually have to be fought, because at some point we will shut down the border, because things will have gotten that bad. When we do that, we will immediately be at war with the drug cartels because we've cut off their income. And we're going to have to fight inside the United States as well as on our border. And that's going to demand the United States Army, because our Border Patrol is not nearly as well equipped. They're outgunned, outperformed in every sense, every category of military power by the cartels. What you saw is a good demonstration of just how powerful those cartels are.
So you're saying we could see scenes like this in our country?
Absolutely. It's inevitable.
So the last time a president suggested deploying the U.S. military to the border, the Pentagon scoffed at him, I think unconstitutionally,
yeah,
but they did. Do you think the Pentagon would be willing?
to fight the drug cartels? They seem to have they issue their own orders at this point, it seems.
Well, the fact that you're raising the question is a sad and tragic comment on the state of civil-military relations, that we have people at the top of the military establishment who pick and choose from a menu of tasks and decide what they will or won't do, presumably because there's lots of money in the Ukraine war, and there's not money for them in the Mexican war. And bear in mind that Ukraine and Mexico are just about equally corrupt. The difference is that right now they're killing more people in Ukraine, but the murder rate in Mexico is one of the highest in the world, about 136 out of every 100,000. So it leads most of the world in murder. So it's not that far off. It wouldn't take much to catch up with Ukraine. But as you point out, Ukraine means a lot of money for a lot of people in Washington. Shutting down the border, stopping the influx of illegals, stopping the human trafficking, and going after the drug cartels doesn't really make anybody money.
Last question, that'd be pedantic, but doesn't ignoring or disobeying an order from a president, doesn't that constitute a felony? Isn't that a crime? They're not allowed to do that, are they?
Yes. It is essentially on par with a criminal act. But you've got a chairman who decided to call the leadership of the Chinese military and tell them that, don't worry, if we attack you, we'll let you know in advance.
Why didn't he go to jail for that?
Why is he still holding his office? Why is he still a four-star general? I mean, he's not alone. When's the last time we held anybody in the military accountable for anything?
Sad. Doug McGregor, thank you.
Sure.
Well, that pretty well winds it up for this program. Trying to hope that you got a lot out of those Greg Reese, clips, because he does some very, very insightful things. We've got a new McCarthy. Kevin McCarthy is the new Speaker of the House. There's going to be factions within the Republican of a very conservative 20-member group, Freedom Caucus, and the other normal caucus, that's going to continue to divide them in many of their approaches to future bills. All spending bills have to originate in the House of Representatives. So that's where they intend to try to close down some of this runaway spending. Our debt has gone from $26 trillion to well over $31 to $32 trillion of debt. And we just cannot labor under that forever. So I know the Republicans are always accused of cutting back and not, spending properly. But this is one of the times in America's history where we better start cutting back, or we're going to really collapse the economy. And that dollar, that Greg Reese inevitable collapse of the dollar is coming, and so forth. And we just cannot continue this spending into the trillions of dollars. And there might be a point in the future where we can't even afford to supply our military. Wouldn't that be horrendously evil and very dangerous? Would it not be? But in trying to squeeze out the, supply to the military, is going to hurt other economic sectors and so forth. And so we're in the doldrum of a major change in our economics and our economy. And what we've got to do is we've got to use ingenuity and so forth to continue and turn around the economy. And new businesses, surprisingly, are being formed, and they're going out there and doing some good. So we just might be able to do a little bit more than some of these economists are thinking. And this reset, maybe we can do some offsets. Let's offset the resets. Good night. God bless you.